Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the August 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. You've heard me refer to Washington from time to time as Israeli-occupied territory, or Israel's most important occupied territory. And that has only been partly in jest, given the Israel lobby's stranglehold on Congress and the extent to which key departments of the U.S. government have been openly infiltrated, penetrated, nothing secretive about it, though, by individuals whose prime interest appears to be protecting Israel and not the American people, who they were not only hired to serve, but who also happened to pay their salaries. So far, you've only heard my rants about it. Today, however, I'm going to let you hear an example of what upsets me and should upset every American concerned with the direction this country is being taken, which is quite likely to lead to another war. I'm going to play for you a recent speech by Andrew Shapiro, Assistant Secretary of State for Military and Political Affairs, who used to work for Hillary Clinton when she was a senator and was, according to him, doing what he is doing today in the State Department, and that is whatever he can do for Israel. He was speaking 3 weeks ago on the U.S.-Israel security relationship. Before I do that, I'm going to skip my usual segment of news and opinions and say a few words about the passing of Marilyn Buck, a dear friend of mine who died a week and a day ago in New York. Last week at Democracy Now!, you may have heard Amy Goodman mention her passing. Deathly sick from a rare aggressive form of uterine cancer, Marilyn had been released from the Federal Prison Medical Center in Carswell, Texas on July 15th and paroled to New York, where she was staying with Jill Sophia Elijah, her lawyer and close friend. 3 weeks later, on August 3rd, surrounded by Sophia and other friends, she died. Had Marilyn not taken ill, she would have been released this past Sunday from the Federal Women's Prison in Dublin, California, where she had spent most of the 33 years of an 80-year sentence for opposing racial injustice and U.S. imperialism, and more specifically for assisting in the escape to Cuba of Black Panther leader Assata Shakur. Throughout her years in prison, Marilyn remained a steadfast supporter of her fellow political prisoners and an advocate for all the women with whom she was imprisoned. Prison walls were able to contain Marilyn's body, but not her spirit or imagination. In many ways, she lived a fuller life inside than most of her contemporaries on the outside. Despite her incarceration, she was able to earn a Bachelor of Arts in Psychology and Master of Arts degrees in Poetics and publish several collections of poems and essays that have been printed in a variety of journals and books, which can be found online. And in 2001, she received a Pan American Center Award for her poetry. At the time she was diagnosed with cancer, she was preparing a new collection of poetry to be published early next year under the title Inside Shadows. Marilyn became involved in the civil rights and anti-war movements and joined the Students for Democratic Society while at the University of Texas at Austin and the University of California, Berkeley. She would later become an active supporter of the Puerto Rican, Native American, and Black liberation struggles in this country and a strong champion of women's equality. I met Marilyn in the 60s when she was working with a movement, the monthly newspaper of SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and in the early 70s we came to share a communal apartment. I began visiting her in prison in Washington, D.C. in 1989, and when she was transferred to Dublin, I tried to do it every 5 or 6 weeks until she was diagnosed with cancer in late last December. Marilyn was unable to hear me on the air, but after every program, I used to send her my 7 or 8 pages of news and opinions, like the kind I'm reading to you now. Today, in her memory and her honor, I'm going to read a poem she wrote back in 2000 entitled Black August that memorializes the month in which she died, which is also the most eventful in Black history. I hope my reading of it will give you a sense of her commitment and respect for the long struggle in this country for Black liberation and to those Black brothers still incarcerated in U.S. prisons, condemned to die there for fighting for it. Here's the poem, Black August. Would you hang on a cliff's edge, sword sharp, slashing fingers while jackboot screws stomp heels on peel flesh bones and laugh, let go, die. Die, damn you, die. Could you hang on 20, 30 years? 20 years, 30 years, and more brave Black brothers buried in U.S. concentration camps. They hang on. Black light shining in torture chambers. Ruchelle, Yogi, Sundiata, Sekou, Warren, Chip, Seth, Herman, Jalil, and more they resist. Black August. Nat Turner, insurrection chief, executed. Black August. Jonathan George, Dead in Battle's Light, Black August. Fred Hampton, Black Panthers, Brotherhood, Murdered, Black August. Kawazi Balogun, New Abdi'l-Qayyum, Captured Warriors, Dead, Black August. Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Ella Baker, Ida B. Wells, Queen Mother Moore, Their Last Breaths Drawn, Fighting Death, Black August. Black August, watchword for black liberation, for human liberation, light to lead children of every nation to safety. Black August Remembrance, resist the American nightmare for life. Black August by Marilyn Buck. Those names she called out are probably not familiar to you. They are warriors from another time, when white racist police and sheriffs in America's cities and towns routinely shot and killed young black men without compunction. When the FBI's COINTEL program considered the Black Panthers the greatest nemesis to America. It's only slightly better now, as the murder of Oscar Grant in the Oakland BART station reminds us. In her poem, Marilyn speaks of Rochelle. That's Rochelle Cinque McGee. Over 40 years in prison, no sign of ever getting out. Yogi is Hugo Pinnell, who came to the U.S. as a boy from Nicaragua. He's been in over 45 years. Like Rochelle, he became politicized while in prison, so he will never get out. Sundiata Sundiata Kohli, a former member of the Black Liberation Army, now 36 years behind bars. Sekou, that's Sekou Odinga, also a former member of the Black Liberation Army, going on 30 years inside, who I met in Algiers in 1970 when he was a Black Panther, who returned to the U.S. to continue the struggle for his people as he saw it. Warren was Warren Wells, former Black Panther, who died on the operating table at UCSF in 2001 in his 33rd year behind bars. Chip, that's Romain Chip Fitzgerald, the longest-held Black Panther in over 40 years. Seth, that's Robert Seth Hayes, another former Black Panther now in his 32nd year inside. Herman, that's Herman Bell, former Black Panther now in his 37th year in prison. And Jaleel is Anthony, Jaleel Bottom, convicted along with Herman Bell, also in his 37th year. And Jonathan and George were Jonathan and George Jackson, Jonathan, the younger brother, who was killed in a shootout at the Marin County Courthouse on August 7, 1970, in an effort to free his brother, then at San Quentin. A year and 2 weeks later, on August 21, 1971, George would himself be gunned down in the San Quentin prison yard. The men who are still locked up, all now in the early or late 60s and some in poor health, have been denied parole time and again, not because of their crimes or alleged crimes, but because the system has not been able to break their political spirit, as it could never break Marilyn's. Her name must now be added to the Black August honor roll. Now I'm going to give you the final words of Marilyn in her poem, Wild Poppies. Recorded from prison.
See if this works. Federal prison. I remember red poppies wild behind the schoolhouse. I didn't want to be there, but I loved to watch the poppies. I used to sit in the window of my room sketching charcoal trees. What happened to those magnolias? To that girl? I went off to college, escaped my father's thunderstorms, Berkeley, rebellion, exhilaration. The Vietnam War, Black Power, Che took me to Chicago. Midnight lights under Wacker Drive, Uptown, Southside, slapped by self-determination for taking Freedom Wall photos without asking. On to California, driving at 3 o'clock in the morning in the mountains. I got it. What self-determination means. A daunting task for a young white woman. I was humbled. Practice is concrete, harder than crystal dream concepts. San Francisco on the front steps at Fulton Street, smoking reefer, drinking bitter dog with Black Panthers and white hippie radicals, talking about when the revolution comes. The revolution did not come. Fred Bennett was missing. We learned he'd been found, ashes, bones, a wedding ring. But later there was Asada's freedom smile. Then I was captured, locked into a cell of sewer water, spirit deflated. I survived, carried on, glad to be like a weed, a wild red poppy, rooted in life.
And that was Marilyn Buck reading her poem, Wild Poppies. Marilyn died August 3rd. Now, let's go on to today's main feature. Although that doesn't begin to compare with what we just heard. It's a presentation by Andrew Shapiro, Assistant Secretary of State for Military and Political Affairs in Hillary Clinton and President Obama's State Department, which was made to the Saban Center of the Brookings Institution this past July 16th. The Brookings Institution, founded in 1922, was the oldest and last remaining independent think tank in Washington. And this presented a problem for the pro-Israel lobby, which dominates all the others. Enter Haim Saban, Egyptian-born Israeli billionaire who donated $12.3 million to Brookings in 2002 in order to establish the Saban Center on Middle East Policy, which has successfully robbed the venerable institution of the ability to participate in a meaningful way influencing U.S. Middle East policy in a direction that benefits the United States and not Israel. In the same year, 2002, Saban donated the same amount of money, $12.3 million, to the Democratic Party, $7 million of which was devoted to building its new Washington headquarters. His greatest concern, Saban says, is to protect Israel by strengthening the United States-Israel relationships. At a conference last fall in Israel, Saban described his formula, quote, his three ways to be influential in American politics, he said, were, quote, I make donations to political parties, establish think tanks, and control media outlets. Now the major owner of the Spanish language Univision, he has been successful in doing all three. The first voice you're going to hear today will be Kenneth Pollack. He's director of the Saban Center, who you may remember for having written The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq, published by Random House, also by coincidence, in 2002. It was a bestseller and was thought to be instrumental in getting the American intelligentsia to support the overthrow of Saddam. He then refers to Martin Indyk, who is also sitting on the stage. Indyk is vice president and director of foreign policy at Brookings. He previously served as U.S. ambassador to Israel, Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Near East and South Asia at the National Security Council. In order to be appointed ambassador to Israel by Bill Clinton, the Australian-born Indyk received an expedited citizenship, just another perk for the pro-Israel establishment for whom the ordinary rules seem not to apply. What his bios rarely reveal is that in 2005, while serving as a research director for AIPAC, Israel's official Washington lobby, he was made the founding director of its think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or WINAP. He is a regular talking head on all the network news programs and NPR, but none of his interviewers ever tell their audience his background. I wonder why. Okay, let's go to Andrew Shapiro speaking on the U.S.-Israel security relationship. Afterward, I'll open the phones and you could tell me if what Mr. Shapiro had to say makes you feel more secure.
For those of you who don't know me, I am Ken Pollack. I am the director of the Saban Center here at Brookings. I'm delighted to have you all here today for, I think, what will be an extremely interesting and important session. We're extremely pleased this morning to have with us an old friend of the Saban Center. Andrew Shapiro has been a friend of the center since its inception, a friend of mine for many years, and a friend of Martin Indyk, the Vice President of Foreign Policy Studies here at Brookings, for even longer than that. I think Andrew is well known to many of you. He's been a fixture on the Washington scene for many years. He took over as Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs at the beginning of the Obama administration. Prior to that, I think you all know he was one of then-Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton's key staffers, having served from 2001 to 2009 as her senior defense and foreign policy advisor, a position in which he was her primary policy advisor on a whole range of national security issues, including her work on the Senate Armed Services Committee. In that capacity, Andrew got to spend many fun-filled nights in Baghdad and Kabul, as well as other exotic locales with the senator. And before coming on board with Senator Clinton, Andrew served as the Justice Department's International Competition Policy Advisory Committee, and prior to that, he was an associate at Covington and Burling. Please join me in welcoming the Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs, Andrew Shapiro. Well, Ken, thank you so much for that introduction and for your friendship and for all the work that you're doing here at the Saban Center. And I also want to thank Martin Indyk, the Director of Foreign Policy. Martin gave me my first job, my first paying job in Washington, D.C. over 20 years ago. And he was at another think tank in town. And I was just graduating college unemployed, and I read an op-ed in the New York Times written by him. And I thought it was very good. Some things never change. And I wrote in and asked if he needed anyone, and I got an interview, and I was hired part-time in the fall of 1989. I must say, I was just out of school. I probably didn't set the world on fire, but I begged and pleaded and finally got hired full-time. And I was there in the August of 1990, in the days right before Iraq invaded Kuwait, when there were some rumblings. I remember being at a barbecue at Martin's house, and he predicted that Iraq would take some type of aggressive action against Kuwait. And the experience that I had working for him during that first Gulf War really taught me a lot about Washington policymaking, and it taught me about the importance of clear-headed, well-written, well-thought-out analysis, and Martin has brought those same qualities here to the Brookings Institution, and it's just a great pleasure to be here. Particularly pleased to be here at the Saban Center to address the Obama administration's enduring commitment to Israel security. And I'm proud to say that as a result of this commitment, our security relationship with Israel is broader, deeper, and more intense than ever before. Just last week, President Obama met with Prime Minister Netanyahu and stated that, quote, Israel has unique security requirements. President Obama has ensured that his administration fully recognizes those requirements, and we have redoubled our commitment to meeting them. Indeed, as Assistant Secretary for Political and Military Affairs, one of my primary responsibilities is to preserve Israel's qualitative military edge, or QME. Today, I'd like to tell you how we're preserving Israel's QME through an unprecedented increase in U.S. security assistance, stepped-up security consultations, support for Israel's new Iron Dome defensive system, and other initiatives. We recognize that today Israel is facing some of the toughest challenges in its history. This administration is particularly focused on Israel's security precisely because of the increasingly complex and severe threats that it faces in the region. Israel is a vital ally and a cornerstone of our regional security commitments. When talking about the threat assessment in the region, one must start with the Iranian nuclear program. As Secretary Clinton said in March, for Israel, there is no greater strategic threat than the prospect of a nuclear-armed Iran. While the most grave The Iranian nuclear program is one of many serious security threats in the region. Iran and Syria both pose significant conventional security challenges. And these conventional challenges intersect with the asymmetrical threats posed by Hezbollah and Hamas, whose rockets indiscriminately target Israeli population centers, and whose extensive arms smuggling operations, many of which originate in Tehran and Damascus, weaken regional security and disrupt efforts to establish lasting peace between Israel and its neighbors. We must recognize that the ever-evolving technology of war is making it harder to guarantee Israel's security. For six decades, Israelis have guarded their borders vigilantly, but advances in rocket technology require new levels in U.S.-Israel cooperation. Despite efforts at containment, rockets with better guidance systems, greater range, and more destructive power are spreading across the region. Hezbollah has amassed tens of thousands of short and medium range rockets on Israel's northern border. Hamas has a substantial number in Gaza. And even if some of these are still crewed, they all pose a serious danger. These and other threats to Israel's security and civilian population are real, they are growing, and they must be addressed. And we are standing shoulder to shoulder with our Israeli partners to do so. Coming to my current job, after 8 years as Senator Clinton's primary foreign affairs and defense policy advisor in the Senate, I can personally attest to her deep sense of pride of being a strong voice for Israel. I traveled to Israel with then-Senator Clinton in 2005
to attend a Saban Center conference, and joined her on her first visit to Israel as Secretary of State in March 2009. When it comes to the U.S.-Israel relationship, the policy guidance Secretary Clinton has given me for my current position is no different from the guidance she gave me when I worked for her in the Senate. As the Secretary mentioned in a recent speech, she asked me, coming from this experience of working with her in the Senate, to make the management of our security relationship with Israel and preserving Israel's qualitative military edge among my top priorities. The unique relationship between the United States and Israel is rooted in common values, interwoven cultures, and mutual interests. U.S. support for the idea of a Jewish homeland dates back to John Adams and John Quincy Adams and can be traced through the letters of Abraham Lincoln, Woodrow Wilson, and Franklin Roosevelt. Indeed, when Israel was founded in 1948, the United States was ready to embrace its new partner, and President Truman famously extended official diplomatic recognition to the State of Israel in just 11 minutes. America's commitment to Israel's security and prosperity has extended over many decades and across Democratic and Republican administrations alike. Our leaders have long understood that a robust United States-Israel security relationship is good for us, good for Israel, and good for regional stability. President Nixon paid the first official visit to Israel to begin direct U.S. diplomatic engagement to help bring peace in the region. This began a long bipartisan effort to work toward peace, and in doing so, to further bolster Israel's security as a sovereign state. President Nixon's effort was continued by President Carter with the Camp David Accords, President George H.W. Bush at the Madrid Conference, President Clinton's stewardship of the Oslo Accords and the Y River Conference, in which Brookings' own Martin Indyk played such a central role, and the previous administration's engagement at the Annapolis Conference. President Obama has also made achieving peace and recognized secure borders for Israel a top administration priority. Secretary Clinton, in her speech to AIPAC earlier this year, explained the imperative of pushing the peace process forward because the status quo is unacceptable. In addition to a nuclear-armed Iran, Israel's future as a secure Jewish and democratic state is under threat from the dynamics of demography, ideology, and technology. The Obama administration is working assiduously with the parties to restart direct negotiations toward a comprehensive peace as soon as possible. We believe that through good faith negotiations, the parties can mutually agree on an outcome which ends the conflict and reconciles the Palestinian goal of an independent and viable state based on the 1967 lines with the agreed swaps, and the Israeli goal of a Jewish state with secure and recognized borders that reflect subsequent developments and meet Israeli security requirements. Hand in hand with this commitment to peace has been the administration's unwavering dedication to ensuring that Israel is prepared to defend itself against the multitude of threats it faces. As the president said just last week, the United States is committed to Israel's security. We are committed to that special bond, and we are going to do what's required to back that up, not just with words, but with actions. Since day one, President Obama and Secretary Clinton have not only honored and re-energized America's enduring commitment to Israel's security, but have taken action to expand it to an unprecedented level. Our work is rooted and knowledge shared across the decades by presidents and policymakers on both sides of the aisle, that a strong and secure Israel and an Israel at peace with its neighbors is critical not only to the interests of Israelis and Palestinians, but also to America's strategic interests. As Secretary Clinton has often said, the status quo is unsustainable. Without a comprehensive regional peace, the Middle East will never unlock its potential. And Israel will never be truly secure. The dynamics of ideology, technology, and demography in the region mean this continuing conflict poses serious challenges. Regional peace must begin with the recognition by every party that the United States will always stand by Israel's security. As President Obama put it, no wedge will be driven between us. Israel's right to exist and to defend itself is not negotiable. No lasting peace will be possible unless that fact is accepted. It is our hope that the administration's expanded commitment to Israel's security will advance the process by helping the Israeli people seize this opportunity and take the tough decisions necessary for a comprehensive peace. For decades, the cornerstone of our security commitment to Israel has been assurance that the United States would help Israel uphold its qualitative military edge, a commitment that was written into law in 2008. Israel's QME is its ability to counter and defeat credible military threats from any individual state, coalition of states, or non-state actor, while sustaining minimal damages or casualties. The Obama administration has demonstrated its commitment to Israel's QME by not only sustaining and building upon practices established by prior administrations, but also undertaking new initiatives to make our security relationship more intimate than ever before. Each and every security assistance request from the Israeli government is evaluated in the light of our policy to uphold Israel's qualitative military edge. At the same time, QME considerations extend to our decisions on defense cooperation with other governments in the region. This means that as a matter of policy, we will not proceed with the release of military equipment or services that may pose a risk to allies or contribute to regional insecurity in the Middle East. The primary tool that the United States uses to ensure Israel's qualitative military edge is security assistance. For some three decades, Israel has been the leading beneficiary of U.S. security assistance through the Foreign Military Financing Program, or FMF. Currently, Israel receives almost $3 billion per year in U.S. funding for training and equipment under FMF. The total FMF account is $5 billion annually and is distributed among some 70 countries. So it is a testament to our special security relationship that each year Israel accounts for just over 50% of U.S. security assistance funding distributed through FMF. The Obama administration is proud to carry on the legacy of robust security assistance for Israel. Indeed, we are carrying this legacy to new heights at a time when Israel needs our support to address the multifaceted threats it faces. For fiscal year 2010, the administration requested $2.775 billion in security assistance funding specifically for Israel, the largest such request in U.S. history. Congress fully funded our request for FY 2010, and we requested even more, $3 billion, for FY 2011. These requests fulfill the administration's commitment to implementing the 2007 Memorandum of Understanding with Israel to provide $30 billion in security assistance over 10 years. This commitment directly supports Israel's security, as it allows Israel to purchase the sophisticated defense equipment it needs to protect itself, deter aggressors, and maintain its qualitative military edge. Today, I can assure you that even in challenging budgetary times, this administration will continue to honor this 10-year, $30 billion commitment in future fiscal years. But our unique security assistance relationship with Israel extends beyond raw numbers. Unlike other beneficiaries of foreign military financing, which are legally required to spend funds in the United States, Israel is the only country authorized to set aside one quarter of its FMF funding for offshore procurements. This exception provides a significant boost for Israel's domestic defense industry, helps them to develop indigenous defense production capacity, and is one of many ways we demonstrate our commitment to meeting Israel's unique security requirements. A second way we build Israel's qualitative military edge is through training and joint military exercises, such as last fall's Juniper Cobra 2010 ballistic missile defense exercises. More than 1,000 U.S. troops participated in Juniper Cobra, which was the largest U.S.-Israeli exercise in history. U.S. and Israeli forces take part in numerous exercises each year to test operational concepts, improve interoperability, and focus on urban terrain and counterterrorism operations. These collaborative efforts enhance Israel's military capabilities and improve our own military's understanding of and relationship with the Israeli Defense Forces. In addition, many Israeli officers and enlisted personnel attend U.S. military schools, such as the National War College, where they can acquire essential professional skills and build lifelong relationships with their U.S. military and other foreign counterparts. Third, the United States supports Israel's defense needs through both our government-to-government foreign military sales program and through direct commercial sales, including releasing advanced products restricted only to the closest of allies and partners. In the past years, we have notified Congress of a number of significant sales aimed at preserving Israel's qualitative military edge, most notably the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. The F-35's advanced capabilities will prove a key contribution to upholding Israel's QME for many years to come. Israel further benefits from a war reserve stockpile, which is maintained in Israel by U.S. European Command and used to boost Israeli defenses in case of a significant military emergency. And like many of our partners overseas, Israel is also able to access millions of dollars in free or discounted military equipment each year through the Department of Defense's Excess Defense Articles program. Fourth, the United States and Israel have long cooperated in research and development of military equipment. Given the threat Israel faces from short and medium-range missiles, Israel air and missile defense systems are an area of particular focus, including the Arrow weapon system to counter long-range ballistic missile threats and David Sling to defend against short-range ballistic missiles. For our part, we are working with Israel to upgrade its Patriot air and missile defense system, which was first deployed during the Gulf War, and have installed advanced radar systems to provide Israel early warning of incoming missiles. Israeli origin equipment deployed on Iraqi and Afghan battlefields are protecting troops every day. This includes armor plating technology for U.S. military vehicles and unique medical solutions such as the Israeli bandage, a specifically designed antibiotic-treated dressing that has been widely used by our men and women in uniform in Iraq and Afghanistan. It also includes sensors, surveillance equipment, unmanned aerial vehicle technology, and detection devices to seek out IEDs. Many such partnerships and investments between our two governments and U.S. and Israeli defense firms have yielded important groundbreaking innovations that ultimately make us all safer. What I have laid out here represents the core pillars of the U.S.-Israeli security cooperation. But given the breadth of our relationship, I've only really begun to scratch the surface. The United States and Israel are also working closely in a series of other activities to enhance our shared security, from efforts to shut down the vast networks of tunnels being used to rearm Hamas, to tracking and combating terrorist financing, to countering the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, their delivery systems, and related military materials through the Proliferation Security Initiative. A prime example can be found in our joint effort to prevent and interdict the illicit trafficking of arms, ammunition, and weapons components into Gaza. In 2009, the United States and Israel began intensive consultations to address this threat, a top agenda item whenever we meet for bilateral security talks. These efforts have since expanded into a wider international effort under the Gaza Counter-Arms Smuggling Initiative, or GCASI. Under this multinational partnership, the United States joins Canada, Denmark, France, Germany, the Netherlands, Norway, and the UK, along with Israel and Egypt, to employ a broad range of diplomatic, military, intelligence, and law enforcement tools to block the shipment of arms, including rockets, missiles, and related components, into Gaza, which safeguards neighboring Israeli communities and promotes regional security. But what I really want to emphasize is that this administration's commitment to Israel's security is more than just a continuation and strengthening of existing policies. Rather, we have been cultivating new ways to ensure Israel's security and enhance our bilateral political military relationship. During the past year, there has been an unprecedented reinvigoration of bilateral defense consultations through nearly continuous high-level discussions and visits. We have re-energized structured dialogues such as the U.S.-Israel Joint Political Military Group and the Defense Policy Advisory Group, among others. I lead the U.S. government's discussions within the Joint Political Military Group, which includes representatives from both the State Department and the Pentagon on the U.S. side, and the foreign and defense ministries on the Israeli side. The JPMG discussions cover a wide range of political military topics, including, first and foremost, maintaining Israel's qualitative military edge. Meanwhile, the DOD-led Defense Policy Advisory Group provides a high-level forum dedicated to enhancing defense policy coordination. This only reflects what we have been doing publicly with our Israeli partners. Just as important as this public cooperation and collaboration is what you don't see. For instance, our regular and well-established meetings have recently been supplemented by an unprecedented number of intimate consultations at senior levels of our governments. These small private sessions allow us to frankly discuss a wide range of current security concerns, ranging from defense procurement to regional security. These consultations provide an opportunity for our governments to share perspectives on policies, address mutual concerns, explain threat perceptions, and identify new areas for cooperation. Our constant communication with the government of Israel over the past year has helped us to more fully understand and appreciate the many unique security challenges that Israel must live with each and every day. Let me now turn to another area where we are deepening our security relationship with Israel. The rocket threats from Hezbollah and Hamas represent the most immediate challenge. This is a very real daily concern for ordinary Israelis living in border towns such as Sderot, or who know that a rocket fired from Gaza may come crashing down at any moment. As a senator, President Obama traveled to Israel and met with families whose homes had been destroyed by rockets. So the president understands this threat. Secretary Clinton understands it, and I understand it. That is why earlier this spring, the president asked Congress to authorize $205 million to support the production of an Israeli-developed short-range rocket defense system called Iron Dome. This $205 million for Iron Dome, which has been authorized in the House, and is above and beyond the $3 billion in foreign military financing that the administration requested for Israel in FY 2011. One of my colleagues in the Bureau of Political Military Affairs recently had a chance to see the Iron Dome training battery while in Israel for bilateral consultations and was able to witness a simulation of the system's promising new capabilities. Iron Dome will be a part of a comprehensive layered defense against the threat of short-range rockets fired at the Israeli population. This funding will allow Israel to expand and accelerate Iron Dome production and deployment to provide timely improvements to their multi-tiered defense. This step is one in a series that demonstrates the strength of our mutual defense relationship and shows how serious we are about ensuring that our enhanced security dialogues translate into action. Iron Dome fills a gap in Israel's multi-tiered defense system. Israel has conducted thorough tests of Iron Dome components, and we've conducted an evaluation of our own. We are confident that Iron Dome will provide improved defense for the people of Israel. Helping to make Israel's population more secure from the short-range rocket and missile threat its border towns face is not only the right thing to do, but is the type of strategic step that is good for Israel's security and for the United States' interests in the region. Bolstering Israel's security against the rocket threat will not by itself facilitate a two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Conversely, a two-state solution will not in and of itself bring an end to these threats. But our support for Iron Dome and similar efforts do provide Israel with the capabilities and the competence that it needs to make take the tough decisions ahead for a comprehensive peace. U.S. support for Israel's security is much more than a simple act of friendship. We are fully committed to Israel's security because it enhances our own national security and because it helps Israel to take the steps necessary for peace. As Secretary Clinton has suggested, we cannot entrust Israel's future to the status quo. And the most certain way to ensure Israel's future as a democratic state is through a sustainable regional peace. We will also continue to support our words with concrete actions. The U.S.-Israel security relationship is too important to be anything less than a top priority. As surely as the bond between the United States and Israel is unbreakable, our commitment to Israel's qualitative military edge has never been greater. And I can assure you that under the leadership of President Obama and Secretary Clinton, our relationship will always receive time, attention, and focus that it deserves. Thank you for your time and attention this morning.
And that was Andrew Shapiro, Assistant Secretary of State for Military and Political Affairs of the U.S. government, supposedly, speaking at the Brookings Institution July 16th. During the question period, Medea Benjamin of Global Exchange was there. The sound wasn't very good, but she spoke up and said to Mr. Shapiro, "You sound more like an agent of Israel." And she got applause from some people in the audience for that. It is now 16 minutes before 10 o'clock, before the hour. And if you have any comments or questions, do you feel more secure after listening to Mr. Shapiro's speech? What do you think about that? Perhaps you have some thoughts about Marilyn Buck. The number here, of course, is 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117. Looks like we have a call here. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yes, yeah, I got you, yes.
I am afraid that Mr. Shapiro emphasized again and again, I wish I'd counted them, he talked about Israel's security. He never mentioned the security of the Middle East once. He never mentioned the security of the other governments who neighbor upon Israel. And who have nothing like the military might nor the atomic weapons. It was very interesting. It was all about Israel's security and nothing else. He is surely an agent of Israel. Just wanted to say that until Israel becomes a democratic state and not a Jewish state, a medieval Jewish state, we'll never have security for the people of Israel. They'll live in the insecure fear that they are under now and have been for almost 60 years. That's about all I want to say. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks for your call. We have another line here. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, hey, thank you for an incredible piece of radio work. Absolutely very, very important and very smart to run it. That was very impressive indeed. And I would just like to say that no one really defines my political position. Certainly the Democrats have lost my support. I've been with Obama ever since Iowa. And yet now I believe that it's a possibility that President Obama may be thinking of nuking Iran and of nuking ancient Persia, the most cultivated and gentle people on earth. And the loss of American sovereignty. I mean, there is no way that I can even comment in an articulate way on the depth and the importance of that piece that you just played. We all understand it, I'm sure. So let me get off the phone and let other people talk. But I would just like to make the comment that this militarism extends right down to Mendocino. That it is not sufficient for us to put our heads in the sand. The militarism of American life and the general ideology of militarist control and laying the groundwork for a police state of nuclear aggression against the rest of the world, these are our business as Mendocino people. Now, I'm probably not making too much sense, but that was a tremendously exciting piece of information that you released, and I keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's something, if American people, the majority of American people, would have heard a speech like that, even those Jews who support Israel.
I'm a Jew.
Yeah.
I'm a Jew.
Yeah, would be outraged.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the most intractable parts of this problem is that the people that are doing this in Israel are Jewish, but they're coincidentally Jewish. You might as well say that the American thermonuclear aggression that's directed against the world is the responsibility of Swedes. You know, it is true that there are, that it is a Jewish phenomena, which is a little weird. But in general, this is a Israeli Zionist militarist state. It is only coincidentally Jewish. It's no more like calling Pol Pot a Buddhist. So anyway, thank you very much for the program.
Well, thank you for your call. By the way, in the New Atlantic magazine coming out very soon, Jeff Goldberg, Jeffrey Goldberg, who formerly served as a prison guard in the Israeli Defense Forces, right, who's a writer for the Atlantic magazine, has written an article called "Will Israel Really Attack Iran Within a Year?" And Haaretz broke the story, parts of the story in today's paper. And he is saying, he's writing, one day next spring, the Israeli National Security Advisor, Uzi Arad, and the Israeli Defense Minister, Ehud Barak,
right,
will call the, will simultaneously telephone their counterparts at the White House and the Pentagon to inform them that their Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has just ordered roughly 100 F-16s, F-15s, other aircraft of the Israeli Air Force to fly east toward Iran, possibly by crossing Saudi Arabia or by threading the border between Syria and Turkey, and possibly by traveling directly through Iraq's airspace, though it's crowded with American aircraft, to bomb Iran. It's more likely that Israel will do it, and because they know the American Congress is totally behind them, but it is the only thing that's stopping it right now is the Pentagon, because they know, and the Intelligence Department, they know what a catastrophe such a war will cost. But we have the equivalent of
a world meltdown catastrophe, an unbelievable disaster for the planet. Listen, I know I have to get off the line, but just let me encourage you.
Yes.
Expand this coverage, because this is an emergency issue. You know, your radio station only has an hour or two of hard information every day, and the rest of it is music. This is an emergency. You need to get back on, not wait for your 2 weeks to elapse. This needs to be a weekly or have a daily update. Why shouldn't we have a daily update on the potentiality of the United States committing a nuclear aggression, or Israel, as you say, under American auspices? That's an emergency. Anyway, you know, I really think that you should be on every damn day.
thank you for the compliment, and thanks for your thoughts. I know it is an emergency, and should there be an attack on Iran, it will make the Iraq war seem like a garden party.
It'll make all of history seem like just a footnote.
Right.
Anyway, good afternoon.
Anyway, thank you so much for your call.
Now, thank you for doing your work.
Thank you. It is now 10 minutes before the hour. We have two open lines at the moment. And I should mention, just along these lines, last week you may have heard that there is a little short conflict on the Israeli-Lebanese border in which some Lebanese soldiers were killed and an Israeli officer was killed. And what happened was that there was a fence that was put up by Israel between them and Lebanon, and an Israeli vehicle with a crane was reaching over the fence with the crane. There were photographs of this, to cut a tree on the other side of the fence. The other side of the fence, the UN says, happens to also be in Israel, but Israel put this fence up. And now we have Howard Berman, Congressman Howard Berman, another Israeli agent in Congress, and Nita Lowy, another Israeli agent in Congress, one from California, one from New York, who have put on a hold U.S. military assistance to Lebanon. Berman said yesterday, press release, "I have been concerned for some time about reported Hezbollah influence on Lebanese armed forces and its implications for our military assistance program for Lebanon. For that reason, on August 2nd, I placed a hold on $100 million security assistance package for the Lebanese armed forces. The incident on the Israeli-Lebanese border, only one day after my hold, was simply reinforces the critical need of the United States to conduct an in-depth policy review of its relationship with the Lebanese military." We have another call. We're going to see you. Hello, you're on the air.
Hey, Jeff. Great show.
Thank you.
Quick question. Can you comment on the fact if there's any Israeli dual citizenship people working in our Congress?
As far as I know, there are none, and I don't think there could be any. When Michael Oren, who is currently the U.S. ambassador to Israel, who is an American, was an American citizen for a number of years, but very pro-Israeli, had actually lived in Israel, worked in Israel. I think he had been in the Israeli Defense Forces himself. He decided to become a, he was appointed Israeli ambassador. He had to give up his citizenship. Rahm Emanuel, in 1991, during the first Gulf War, volunteered in Israel with the Israeli Defense Force, the Israeli Army, as a volunteer for Israel, as a program which allows, encourages Jews from outside of Israel to go to Israel and spend 2 weeks on an army base, which frees up Israeli soldiers to go and do what soldiers usually do, either occupy or make war. It started in 1982 during the Lebanon and Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And I remember Judge Quentin Kopp in San Francisco, wasn't a judge at the time, was very proud of leaving his job as a lawyer and supervisor of San Francisco to go over to Israel and serve on an Israeli base, which allowed the Israeli soldiers to leave that base and go and do their marauding in Lebanon as they did, 17,000 civilians dead. We don't even hear about that anymore. Rahm Emanuel, as far as I know, is not an Israeli citizen. And we hold. Hello. Let's see. Hello, you're on the air.
Oh, Jeff, I just want to say thank you. You are the best, and I'm not articulate enough this morning to comment in very much. It just made me sick. I'm really sick of the militaristic crud that's going on in this country, and the American people being screwed, really. And I'm tired of kowtowing to the Israelis. I said to Congressman Thompson once, I said, is this the United States of America or the United States of Israel? Since we are backing them up in the Gaza thing with all our guns and weapons, I'm just so fed up. I've been a lifelong Democrat, but I'm ready to drop out of that one. And I thank you so much for what you do. Thank you. Well, it made me sick, though. But hey.
I want you to be not sick, but angry.
Yeah, I'm angry, too, but... we do? They don't listen, you know, and they're bought and sold just like with the Israeli lobby, and I don't know. We're little people. We don't have health care. We don't have this. We don't have that. You see people looking dumber every day. I mean, we have smartphones. dumb people. That was my bumper sticker. But smart people and smart drones. And you look out there, and the people are looking dumber. I mean, there's no education system is going down. But you can get in the Army real quick, and you can have a couple felons, too. But anyway, thank you, Jeff. You're great. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call. I do appreciate that.
All right.
I knew this program today would stir some things up. I actually was in, I mentioned a while back, I was in Washington last month appearing on a panel with Professor John Mearsheimer and another, in my previous guest afterwards, Sasha Polakoff-Saransky, writing a book, who wrote a book called, which I interviewed him about, called The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Relations with Apartheid South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And another guest of mine, Grant Smith, who was talking about Israel's theft of nuclear material from the United States, and we did not get a single line of press coverage. This is the time Netanyahu was being hosted by President Obama, because obviously AIPAC went to all the media. They did not want any coverage. And in the speech that I just played for you, during the question period, the Syrian ambassador asked Mr. Shapiro about Israel's nuclear weapons, and even Shapiro could not acknowledge that Israel nuclear weapons. He said to the Syrian ambassador, who was shaking his head with disgust, you've said it, not me, that the United States cannot, any U.S. official, including the President of the United States, cannot speak about Israel's nuclear weapons. Just shows the depth of control that this government is under, is intimidated by, especially come election time, when they're counting on contributions from wealthy Jewish donors who don't represent the majority of Jewish people.
Yeah, well, I keep getting asked for donations from the Democratic Party because I gave $10 last year or something, and they call me at the worst times, and I said, I just tell them to go, you know. I mean, what is it? It's just awful. It's just, there's nothing... Anything like the Republicans, I could never vote for a Republican, but I'm real fed up with the Democrats right now.
Our choices get worse.
Yeah, the choices get worse. All right, gotta go. Love you. Bye-bye.
So thanks so much for calling.
Bye.
And thank all of you who called. We're coming down to the end of the hour next week. Joy LeClaire will be here by telephone, by technological marvels, and she'll be interviewing James Tabor, who's written a book called Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. Maybe we're all going to be looking for that. That's going to be next week on Forthright Radio here on Wednesday. You can, by the way, you can now listen again to my takes on the world by going to radioforall.net and go to producers and go to my name first, Jeff Blankfort, and you can listen to my programs online again. And I hope you do that and send them to your friends. And I want to thank you again all for listening. We're going to go to Earth and Sky, and then Jim Denton will entertain you with Beyond Bach. The time is now 9:58, and you're listening to all of this, of course, on KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Williston, Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and streaming on the World Wide Web at kzyx.org. Thanks again for listening. See you in a couple of weeks.